Welcome to our newest adventure for first responder wellness. No one fights alone. In-depth conversations about mental health and culture in the first responder space. We're joined by your co-hosts, Austin Pedersen and Brad Shepard.
We are so excited to have Captain Matt Blush with us today from the Fairfield, California Police Department. Matt's been on the department for 25 years, and he's been married for 26 years, got a couple kids. Matt, welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast.
Thanks, Brad. Glad to be here.
Hey, it's interesting that we've tried to connect for, several times. We've seen each other kind of coming and going, and we've never really connected. We got to connect a little bit in Louisville. I think that's where it was. We actually finally said, hey, we need to have a conversation. But I remember missing you. You did a talk in Grapevine, Texas, down for the Cop Survivors conference, or that new one they put on.
Yep.
This year. And I was so disappointed that you came walking out, and everybody was saying, Matt did such a great job. Matt had such a great talk. And I missed it. I was terribly disappointed that I missed your conversation in there.
Oh, well, thank you. I was a little stressed out. I couldn't remember much at the end, but
no worries. No, you did a great, well, for what everybody said, but it's been great connecting with you, and I'm so grateful to have you on, Matt. So, hey, you've got a great story. Tell us a little bit about, well, I use that loosely. It's a story. It's typical of No One Fights Alone podcast. It's a story of pain and love and redemption. And I kind of want us to dive in it. Just take us on a little story journey here, if you will.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Yeah. So we'll go back to the very beginning. So I was born in San Francisco. My dad was a San Francisco cop. I grew up in the county just north of the city, and wanted to be a cop my whole life. Wanted to be just like my dad. So when I was 13, he was killed on duty in an accidental shooting in the locker room. Horrible, horrible incident. But that basically changed the trajectory of my life. You know, losing my dad at 13 years old. My parents were married. I was the oldest of three. So at the time I was 13, my sister was 9 and a half, and my brother was 3. So that really changed the course. Growing up prior to that was pretty normal. You know, both parents in the home, and, you know, we lived in the suburbs. And it was what I thought was normal. We were close with my grandparents and aunts, uncles, and all that stuff. What I didn't realize at the time, what I know now, there was a lot of alcohol involved in a lot of what we did. I think being an Irish Catholic law enforcement family, that's just kind of what happened. You know, you drink to celebrate, you drink to mourn, you drink to drink. And I just grew up around that. I saw it. So it was never that big of a deal. But I mentioned that because when I was 14, is really when I, like, I'm an adolescent, getting into the world and, you know, learning my way of the world and all that stuff, and kind of lost a little bit without having that father figure in my life. But I did, alcohol kind of became a part of my path and my journey at that point. So my freshman year of high school, I was a big kid. So my freshman year in high school, I got a fake ID. And so I was able to buy alcohol for my friends.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it, like, that was my ticket to being social, being around other people. And so I went through high school, and, you know, I was kind of a party animal. Ran two tracks, which is good. So, I would go out and party, but at the same time, I got into the Explorer program at my local fire department. So that was good. I had, like, a positive outlet and some role models and something that kept me out of trouble, because I knew I couldn't get in too much trouble on one side and then still be able to be a fire explorer on the other. So I went through high school, did that. When I graduated high school, I went up to a party school, northern end of the state. My first semester, I studied at fire science, and it bored the heck out of me. So after my first semester, I changed my major to administration of justice. And I knew 10 minutes into my first administration of justice class that law enforcement is what I was born to do. There was no question. I had done the fire stuff because I wanted to protect my mom. After what happened to my dad, I knew that she probably wouldn't approve of me going into this career field. It's a calling, right? I didn't choose this job. It chose.
So how did your mom take it?
She actually took it fairly well. I didn't tell her directly. I told some of her friends, and then they told her. So I got a phone call, and she said, "Well, I'm not happy about what you're doing, but if it's what you want to do, I support you 100%. So that was a relief. So I was in school, partied a lot, had a good time. And so as it turns out, I was dating this girl, things were going well. And then, we had talked about making it a long-term relationship. And then, lo and behold, one day we had a conversation and she says, "Guess what? We're having a baby." Sweet. Okay. We're going to do this. So we put the cart before the horse. That long-term relationship, definitely that sealed the deal. We didn't run out and get married right away, but my daughter was born, and that was good. She is amazing. And so I was trying to go to school and, raise a child, and pretty soon my wife and I were both working part-time jobs and going to school and, really struggling to make it through. But I finally had to drop out of school and work full-time to earn a living and have benefits. And that was important. So I did that. I had a job in sales. It was a great job. So I was doing that. The only issue was it was in the tobacco industry, and I saw where the future there was going, which was not good as far as having a career and maintaining a family. So I decided to get back into law enforcement, and I put in an application at the sheriff's department in the county where I'd grown up, and I got hired. So when I went to the academy, my daughter was 3 and my wife was pregnant. We had gotten married a couple years later. And then we got married about a year before I got hired at the sheriff's department. And then when I got hired, she was pregnant with our son, and he was born when I was in the academy.
How'd your wife feel about you transitioning into law enforcement? Did she share any concern like your mother?
She was good with it. When my wife and I met, we were both taking administration of justice classes at Butte College. So she knew that's what I wanted to do. I went into the sales thing because that was a job like right now with benefits, and I did well with that. But when I got the job at the sheriff's department, I think she was probably more relieved because it was more steady work. And, she knew that had been my career path in the beginning. So it worked out well.
Did she have a family did she come from a law enforcement family?
No, she came from a military family. So, she had a little bit of understanding.
She kind of already got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So, we were married. I went to the police academy. My son was born when I was in the police academy. And then, my career started. Just a little side note now, because I look back on this and, just the path of everything. When I finally was hired by the sheriff's department and I got sworn in, like, that was it. I had truly arrived, right? I finally got to put the uniform on, I put a badge on, and I just knew this is what I was born to do. And this is it, I'm here. So when I went to the academy, like, that was my focus, was the academy. I need to graduate. Like, failure is not an option. So my son was born on a Thursday afternoon, and I should mention the academy was about 3 hours from home, so I was living on site at the academy. But I'm, and my wife was overdue. We were going through this stuff, and she, anyway, so Thursday afternoon, I call to check in and see how she's doing. The nurse says, oh, congratulations. She just gave birth to your son, a baby boy. And I'm like, well, okay. So I got in my truck and I drove to the hospital 3 hours away. And when I got there, you know, I went up and I gave my wife a kiss and I held my son and, you know, and I told the nurse to wake me up at 2 a.m. because I had to leave and be back at class the next morning. And so that's what I did. I held my son. I hung out for a couple hours. And at 2 a.m, the nurse woke me up. And at 7:30 the next morning, I was in uniform, standing at attention in formation at the academy, because that's what I'm going to do. And that's my priority. So did that, graduated the academy. So towards the end of the academy, my wife moved closer to home. We got a condo close to the department, and I started my career. So I had a good time working for the sheriff's department. I had arrived, my priority was still work, you know, and it really fulfilled my purpose in life. My identity became the police or the sheriff's department at the time. I hadn't lateraled yet. So, you know, going through every opportunity to work overtime, I took it. And it wasn't about the money. It was about being at work. And it was about putting the uniform on and that feeling that I got when I was, when I wasn't working, you know, I was hanging out with the guys from work, and there was a lot of alcohol involved in everything that we did. Early on, I was asked to be a part of the honor guard, which was, it was really cool. That was like, I was in the club, you know, and
right.
There was a lot of events surrounding that, and a lot of alcohol involved in the events that we did, not beforehand, but afterwards.
Afterwards.
And, sure. You know, going out drinking with the guys, and it was really cool. While I was doing all this, of course, you know, my wife's home with the kids, and I'm doing my part, right? I'm going to work. I'm earning a paycheck. That's my job. That's my role.
I have to say, if I could jump in here,
yeah.
I have to say one of the most endearing assignments of my career was being assigned to the honor guard for my department as well. There was just something very fulfilling about attending funeral services for active and retired in that fashion. And I will say too, after it was over, there was a lot of honoring with liquid. But at the time, I mean, they were hot day. If it was hot, it was really hot. If it was cold, it was really cold. But, that honor guard assignment was really, fulfilling.
It was
really, really neat assignment.
Yeah. I loved it. And for me, I think it was a chance to, I felt like it was my, every time I went out there and I put that uniform on, I was also representing my dad. And I was also honoring him.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I remember being at my dad's funeral at 13 years old, watching these officers in uniform and stand guard at the casket. And they all looked so sharp. And it was like, okay. And then when I was able to do that, boy, that's how I carried myself. And that's who I was doing it for and what I was
doing. Wow, that's powerful. Yeah.
So it was really cool. And
that's great.
So, you know, doing that, I really loved that department and working there. But being so close, deep in the San Francisco Bay Area, buying a house, you know, we had to buy a house that was over an hour away, and the commute was horrible. So after about 5 years at the sheriff's department, I switched and I came to my current department, which is only 10 minutes from home. And that made a huge difference with the shorter commute. So I started over, you know, as a police officer, and just had a blast. The department that I work for is really busy, so we get to do all the fun stuff that cops get to do, you know? And after a few years, I promoted to sergeant. When I promoted to sergeant, I was assigned to our gang unit, and, you know, we're doing all the fun stuff, running and gunning and, you know, the call outs. And, you know, I felt really important because I was still, you know, this job still is who I was, you know, that whole time. So my wife was a stay at home mom. She's staying home with the kids. Again, you know, my whole identity, I'm Matt the cop. And anything that I could do, every time that phone went off, at the time it was Nextels, you know, and you get the little beep, beep. And I got so excited because, you know, work is calling, work needs me. And I would go off to work and do my thing. So, you know, when I wasn't working, you know, I like to go out and hang out with my friends and party on the weekends. And I didn't really know how to have fun without drinking. And I never really thought that alcohol was an issue, or I never really thought it was a problem, because I wasn't drinking at work. I wasn't drinking out of a brown bag under a bridge. I had never gotten a DUI. So I didn't see alcohol as a problem in my life, but it was definitely a big part of my life. So going on, you know, my focus was work, and all of my eggs were in the work basket. Without realizing it, hindsight being 2020, my relationship with my wife wasn't a relationship anymore. We were like roommates. We would pass each other in the hallway, and, you know, I'd give her the head nod as I'm coming in from graveyard and she's coming out to get the kids ready for school. I'm going to bed, she's coming out. And the only conversations we had were logistics. How are we getting the kids to practice? What do we need from the grocery store? That was it. That was the extent of our relationship. And so I didn't really have that foundation at home. I didn't have a base at home. Everything was work. And what I thought, you know, my job, my role is really to just be a provider. And it didn't matter if I wasn't being a good dad or a good husband at home, I was being a provider. There's a roof over our heads. There's food on the table. My kids are fed. My job's done. So as I went through, you know, I'm caring a lot, and working in a busy town, a lot of stuff happens. And so, you know, as first responders, we go to everyone's stuff on their worst days. So whether it's, you know, the car accidents, the suicides, the child abuse cases, the death notifications, you know, going and telling, it doesn't matter if, you know, when a gang member gets shot, we can try to say, oh, well, that's just a gang member, right? And separate ourselves from that. But then when you have, at the end of the day, it's still a teenager. And then when you have to go tell that teenager's parents that they were just murdered in the middle of the street, like, it takes its toll. But I never talked about any of that stuff. I grew up, you know, the unwritten rules are boys don't cry, don't show your emotion, you know, emotion is weakness. And I thought if I displayed any of that, you know, I would be cut from the herd and voted off the island. The island being my police department family, because those were the people that I was surrounded with. That was my identity. And I wasn't alone when I was with those people. But when I was off duty, all I could think about was, you know, work, getting back to work. And then all of these, you know, all the incidents just kept kind of flooding in, and it kind of circled around in my head. And, you know, I realized that at one point I thought, well, maybe the drinking's getting a little too much. You know, maybe I need to stop that. And then I would tell myself, well, no, it's fine. You know, but on my days off, on my weekend, it's 3 o'clock in the morning and I'm sitting in a dark living room by myself drinking, you know, whatever I poured myself out of the liquor cabinet to try to go to sleep or to try to calm the nerves. So it all kind of came collapsing down one night. It all happened. Really, the other turning point when things really changed in my life is I got a phone call. I was at work and I got a phone call from a guy that used to work with my dad. And he was calling on behalf of the guy who had accidentally shot my dad and wanted to know if I was willing to sit down and meet and like kind of put some closure to this thing. Cause it had been 22 years. I think it had been 22 years at the time. And
wow.
So it was like, it was tough. But when I got this phone call, I said, yes, I can do this, because I had put up this facade, right? Everything is good. I've got a good job. I'm a sergeant. I'm, you know, working for a good police department. I'm married. I have two kids. Life is good. Everything is put together. Everything's perfect. And I had to put up this facade that everything's perfect, right? I had to be perfect. And so I'm like, yeah, absolutely. I can do this. And we had a brief conversation and, you know, we were going to talk about it, you know, in a few days and work out logistics or whatever. And I hung up that phone and it was just like this shadow fell upon me. It was like, what in the heck just happened? So I didn't know what to do. The scary thing is I was at work at the time. So without knowing what to do, I just went and I got my police car and dropped it into drive and started driving around town. I don't know where I went. I don't know. Like, I was just driving. And as all this stuff was circling around in my head, and what I realized, I need to call someone. I need to talk to someone about this, but I can't call anyone because my wife and I didn't have that relationship. I didn't want to talk to her about it. I didn't want to have to explain everything leading up to it. I had pushed all of my coworkers away. I really pushed all my close friends away, and I had like nobody. So I was in this all alone.
So just for the weight of this, if I can ask a couple of questions about that,
absolutely.
Was this another officer? Did I hear that correctly? This is another officer that had accidentally shot your dad.
Yes.
And had never had never communicated with you or your family up to this point.
Correct.
Wow.
Correct. Yeah.
What a burden he must be carrying.
Yes. Knowing what I know now, I mean, I know that changed his life. It was my dad's partner. So the trauma and everything that he experienced, like, I couldn't imagine being in that spot. But he obviously had been carrying a lot for a long time. And so he reached out through a third party who was another one of the guys that they had worked with. And he managed to track me down and that's how it happened. But yeah, there's so much there. You know, after my dad was killed, we didn't have a lot of connection with the department. And I think, you know, a lot of that had to do with just the awkwardness of the circumstances around my dad's death. And then this other guy, like, he was still working there. And yeah, there's a lot.
Had to be tremendously confusing for how on a ground level of just the partners, how to absorb that, process it, receive it, deal with it on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Just so messy.
Yeah. And you think about, you know, where we have come with officer mental health now and where we're at and the services that are available. Well, guess what? In 1988, that wasn't happening.
Right. Right.
The support systems then are not what they are now.
No, it was get over it.
Yeah.
This happened. Now get over it. Go back to work.
Exactly. And if you can't get over it, then we're going to find something else for you to do.
That's right. Yeah. You're not made for this job.
Yep.
Yeah.
So,
well, getting you back on track. So you're driving around town trying to somehow make sense of what you just consented to do.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yep.
You just consented to talk to the person who killed your father. and now you're driving around town and you don't know where you're at, don't know what's going on. You're just in a fog.
Just in a fog. Fair?
Yeah.
And how am I going to process? Like, this is the biggest, most giant thing that has ever happened to me in my life, right? My dad being killed. Yeah. And then after that happened, like 5 minutes after the funeral, that was put in a bag and put over here on the shelf. And I never dealt with that again. I never talked about that. So that phone call, like, let's just sit in a 22-year time warp and go right back to that day. And so, like, it was unreal. What really finally got my head back in the game was work. Like, things happen for a reason. And like, God decided, okay, you've been in a fog long enough. I need to give you something else to deal with right now. We'll worry about this other thing later. So I had to go back to work and I had to do work stuff. And so I finished work. I put that other thing on a shelf. I got home the next morning and my wife says, how was work? I said, it was fine. It was a long night. I had to do a lot of stuff, you know, whatever, but I'm going to bed. So I go to bed, I wake up in a full blown panic attack because, just the gravity of everything hit me. And I realized I can't do this. Like, I want to do this, but I need some freaking help because my whole life, like, I feel like I've built this house of cards and that house of cards just came tumbling down. So I woke up and I got on the phone with the guy that had called me the night before. And it's funny because he says that he wasn't sure it was me when I called him the second time because I sounded so different. When I called him, I was a wreck. I was in tears. It took me about 45 minutes to say that I want to do this, but I can't do this right now. I need some help because my life is falling apart. And I had never told anyone that my life was falling apart, but here I am with this near stranger on the phone because I was finally done. I had realized that, like, I have nobody and I have nothing. And so, luckily he says, well, if you need help, I know of a place and we're going to get you some help. And so, he was part of a trauma recovery program out here in California. And he says, I know some people, would you be willing, you know, have you heard of this place and would you be interested in attending? And the funny thing is, yes, I had heard of the place. I had heard of the place enough to the point where I had actually written down the phone number and put it in my wallet because I knew that there was some stuff going on. And when I say there was some stuff going on, you know, I thought maybe my drinking was an issue, but I also knew, like, there were days, there were times I didn't want to wake up the next day. I didn't want to be alive anymore. I thought that if I was no longer in the picture, that the world would just be a better place. My kids would be better off. My wife would be better off. And, like, is it even worth going on living anymore? So these are some of the thoughts that had been running around in my head prior to me getting this phone call.
Sure.
But I had written that phone number down and I put it in my wallet and I couldn't call when I was off duty because I didn't have a safe place and I didn't have anywhere to go where I could go have this conversation. So I thought to myself, well, I'll call them when I'm at work because then I'm by myself. I'll be in my police car. You know, I can have that conversation. But when I got to work, I didn't have to call because I felt fine. Right.
Sure.
Because work is easy.
It's your comfort zone.
There's policies and procedures, and there's a checklist that says what you do. We don't have that for home, right? And no one had taught me how to be a husband, and no one had taught me how to be a father. I was just kind of winging it. The only thing that I knew is that I had to be a provider. So getting back on track, I was, like I said, I was on the phone with this guy. He said, we're going to get you some help. And so I got into the program, and so it was eventually, like, we got off the phone. He was making the phone calls to get me into the program. I had to go tell my wife what was going on. And that was interesting enough. I sat down with her and said, look, my life's a mess. I got this phone call last night. I don't know what's going on, but I need to go out to this place to work on my head. And at that point, she's like, yeah, cool, whatever, you know, like, it's just another conference that I'm going to or something. Because we didn't talk about what went on. We didn't have those deep conversations.
Sure. So she didn't really know what was coming.
No.
Of where you were actually going, right?
No.
So your wife is indifferent, and basically, yeah, cool. You go do you. I've got shit going on.
Yep.
And yeah.
And that's what it was. And so, I was going to go to this thing on my own. I did not want anyone from work to know what was going on, and I didn't want anyone from work to know that I was going to this place, because again, stigma, whatever. Like, I have something going on. I need to work on this. But if work finds out that I'm having like emotional issues or trauma or whatever, right, I'm going to get voted off the island. There's something wrong with that guy. So,
because in your mind, you're the only person on your department that is feeling this way. No other officer, right? That's how it always happens.
The only person in my department at this point, I was still the only person in the world that was going through what I was going through.
Right.
I couldn't tell anyone, and I couldn't explain to anyone. And yeah, because if I told anyone, they wouldn't get it. I was the only one.
Right.
So I did go. I got to work that night, and I had to talk to my captain and ask, say, hey, I'm going to need a week off. I got some things going on. I got to go get it worked on. So I'm going to need this time off. And he had just told me and my partner the week prior, hey, we're having some overtime issues. I need the two of you to not take any time off. So I had to go to him and say, well, now I'm going to need this time. And I still remember, it's funny, he said, well, do you need to go home now? Are you okay? And my initial thought was, God, no. No, I don't need to go home now. That's the last place I need to be. So I stayed at work. You know, I went to work. But when I was talking to the guy doing the intake for the retreat, he says, he asked me, he goes, where do you work again? I said, Fairfield. And he says, I know your chief. And I'm like, God damn it. Because he was a new chief. Like, I think our chief, he came from the outside, and I think he had been with our department for like 2 weeks or something. He was brand spanking new. And I'm like, shit, my first experience with this chief is going to be that, you know, I'm going to the nut house.
Yeah, and, so much for keeping it quiet.
I'm like, oh, God. So then, you know, he says to me, he goes, well, how are you paying for this? I go, I don't know. I'll put it on a credit card or whatever. You know, it doesn't matter. And he tells me how much it was. And it was a few thousand dollars at the time. And he says, you know, I know your chief from before, and he helped put this retreat together. And he rattled off a bunch of names of people they'd all worked with together. And I knew some of those names. And I'm like, oh, crap. Okay. So, well, yeah, if you want to call him, you know, great. So this guy who I had never met now places a phone call to my chief. I get a call about 20 minutes later on my cell phone, and it's my chief, who I've never had a conversation with, by the way.
Right.
And he says, hey, I talked to Mike, and I know, he says, we're going to get you out there, and we're going to pay for it. And I know you don't want anyone else to know. So it's between you and me. And that's it. And I was like, okay, wow. Oh my God. So they paid for it. They got me out there, to the retreat. And so when I got there, I was like, I was nervous. I was scared. You know, I didn't want to walk in the door. I didn't know what I was walking into. I didn't know any of these people, and I had no idea what I was getting into. But the one thing that I can say is that I knew I didn't want to be in the frickin' hole that I was in, and I needed to do anything that I can do to get out of it. So I walked in the door knowing, okay, I'm done doing it my way. I just need to listen and be open and whatever I need to do to get out of this hole. So the first night we do introductions, and you know, they partner you up with someone, and you ask each other these interview questions, you know, almost standard with any class. So, you know, why are you here and what's going on? And so the guy that I'm interviewing, who was another client, like I'm interviewing him and asking him these questions, and he's talking about his home situation and his family life and everything that's going on. And for the first time in my life, I'm like, holy smokes, you're telling my story. And, you know, have you been following me around? And it was so, it was unreal for me that someone else actually got it. Like, we're going through the same thing. And so then, you know, he interviewed me and he had the same reaction. We did the introductions, and I went through that week, right? And all these people, all these other cops are opening up and telling what they're going through and their experiences and listening to the informational pieces and talking about family dynamics and upbringing and childhood trauma and all of this stuff. And it was like, holy smokes, I am not alone. And I have a lot to work on. What was really interesting, you know, the first night the head clinician of the retreat was, he was talking about a whole bunch of stuff. And I don't remember anything that he really said during that, except these words really stuck out when he said, if you continue to drink alcohol, you will not get better from your PTSD. And immediately I am like, oh, crap. And that kind of sunk, that really sunk in. I'm like,
I must be in the wrong place.
I'm like, the drinking. Yeah. Cause that's like everything that I did revolved around drinking, whether it was, you know, fishing, camping, those were all just excuses to go outside and drink in different places. But, you know, then we have to take all these little tests and all that stuff. And so now it's Monday morning. It's the first morning and I'm going over the tests with another clinician, and she's, you know, all these different graphs and points and peaks and valleys. And she goes, yeah, this stuff here, this is all, you know, this is indicative of PTSD. And we're talking about this week and all that. She goes, and this other spike over here, that's substance abuse. We're going to have a conversation about that. And I'm like, oh, crap. Like, I just got caught. But, you know, I know why that popped up, because when I was taking that test, I was done lying to myself.
At this point, did you have any indication that your drinking was problematic? I mean, did you have any indication, or was it such an ingrained part of who you were that it just was still not a big deal?
Well, it was an ingrained part of who I was, mm-hmm. but it was a big deal because I realized, like, when I would go out, every time I drank, my wife would get pissed. And then, you know, we would go out, and every now and then she would say, hey, can you drive tonight? Can you not drink? I would like to have a couple glasses of wine with my friends. So can you be the designated driver? And I would get mad. Okay, yes, fine. And then I'd find myself sitting in the corner with my arms folded, pissed off because I can't drink and I'm not having a good time. And right. Then it's like, well, I can have a beer. All right, well, I have one. Well, I can have another one, right? And then 7-8 beers later, now she comes outside and she's all pissed off because I'm getting smashed and she's going to be the one that has to drive home again.
Right.
And
on some level, you knew.
Yeah.
So, okay.
At some point, I'm like, okay. I'm with you. But it just kind of floated. And so that came up and I'm like, all right. But, you know, as it was floating back there before getting out to the retreat, like I would see in magazines and some of this other stuff, you know, are you an alcoholic? Do you have a drinking problem? And I would go through those and I paid attention to those and I looked at them and, you know, every answer there was like yeah, I do this, but, and here's my excuse, you know, and all these yes, buts, and yeah, I can't be an alcoholic because, you know, I drink. You know, well, I'm a cop and I work graveyards and I had to do this and I do that and, you know, all the whatever. But getting out there at the retreat, I realized that all of the yes, buts are still yeses. And Wednesday night, they have an AA piece at the retreat. And so I had to sit down and they put the list of the AA 20 questions in front of you. And as I was going through that, that's when, you know, the yes buts were still yeses. And so I put the yeses down And I thought I was doing pretty good answering those until I saw the grading scale and went, oh, no. I think at that time, I answered like 5 questions as yeses. I go back now and it's probably closer to 12 or 14 when I can be completely honest with myself. But it was like, okay. And then listening to the stories again, listening to what other people had gone through. And, you know, it's funny. I'm sitting out there on the front porch of the retreat and it's Wednesday and they bring in some other folks that are to come talk about the alcohol and the substance abuse piece. So this guy comes walking up and, you know, we all got name tags on. And so he sees my name tag and I introduce myself and he introduces himself and he goes, are you related to Jim Blush? And I'm like, yeah. He goes, I was at your parents' wedding. So this guy,
oh my word,
was now retired from San Francisco PD, but he knew my dad, worked with my dad, knew my parents, and like, here we are now all these decades later. And then listening to him tell his story later that night and the struggles that he went through with alcohol, and he had been sober for a long time. But seeing all that and just realizing, oh my God, like I have so much to learn here. And so that really, that was such a big turning point. And then, you know, EMDR is a big part of the retreat. I did EMDR over a lot of my past trauma, all that. But like that was such a huge turning point in my life. They do a AA meeting that night, the Wednesday night of the retreat. And after going through all of that, I realized like with everything that I'm going through, like, yeah, I got to quit lying to myself. And so I sat in that meeting and I introduced myself as an alcoholic that night at the meeting. And it was like, wow. Oh my God. Really powerful, but I needed to do whatever it took to get better. And I needed to quit lying to myself, quit hiding. Like, I'm not in this alone. And I, instead of separating myself from other people and looking at the differences, I started seeing all of these similarities. And so it really unlocked the key to making the changes in my life that I needed to make. And
you know, I doubt that I'll ever forget the first meeting I sat in where I said, I'm Brad, I'm an alcoholic. That was such a low point in my life. And it rolled off my tongue before I even, like, I didn't command it mentally to do that. And when I heard myself say it, I thought, boy, you're fucking dumb, aren't you? You know, but the freedom immediately after the freedom of, okay, yeah, this is who I am.
Yeah.
And it was just so, I don't know how else to say it. It was just so freeing to say, this is where I'm at. Now we can do something.
Yeah. Because once you've identified the problem, now we can start working through it.
Right.
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 Acceptance is the answer. And once,
that's right.
Once we admit, for me, once I admitted I was an alcoholic, I had accepted it. Now I was able to start working towards the solution.
That's right.
So.
Love that.
The No One Fights Alone podcast is excited to announce the launch of our new merchandise line. Now you can show your support for our mission by purchasing one of our hats, shirts, or hoodies. Our merchandise not only represents our brand and message, but also supports a great cause. A portion of all proceeds will go towards helping individuals and families affected by mental health. Wearing our merchandise not only spreads awareness for our podcast, but also serves as a reminder that no one has to fight alone. Join us in showing your support and spreading the message of hope and community by purchasing one of our No One Fights Alone items today from our website, nofapodcast.com, nofapodcast.com.
let me back up here, and you may actually be telling this soon, but so the guy at the retreat who was at your dad's wedding, worked with your dad, knew your dad, is there going to be a tie-in here later as to how you're going to talk to, did that maybe have some connection with you getting this phone call, this random phone call from your dad's partner that accidentally shot him? Was some of that going through your mind?
There was a little bit. I mean, there was just so much
sure
in all of that, but really the big tie-in for me, and I'll get this out of the way real quick, I never actually met with the other guy.
Okay.
We tried to connect a couple times, some things happened, whatever it was in the universe, we were never actually able to connect.
Okay.
And I say that because people ask me all the time. So let me just cut right to that point before I forget.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that's good.
But I have absolutely forgiven him. He has paid his penance. You know what he did, I know there was no ill intent behind it. And being in this job for 25 years, I have been around other cops that have had accidental discharges. Like, it happens. And whatever happened that day, it's horrible. But I don't carry any ill intent towards the guy that accidentally shot and killed my dad. I don't.
Awesome.
Like, I'm not carrying that around anymore. That's not my issue.
Right.
But the big tie-in for me is that with all of this, is that the worst day of my life happened because my dad was accidentally shot and killed. But the day my life changed, that what turned it around, the absolute catalyst for me getting into help and pulling my life back together and getting help was a phone call that was initiated by that same guy. So that's where it has come full circle. Wow. I wouldn't have made that phone. Had I not gotten that call the night before, I wouldn't have made that phone call. And so I wouldn't have asked for help. So that's where the tie-in is. But there, like, it's all these little God moments, right? These different people showing up at the right time out of nowhere to tell their story, to ask me a question. You know, I had walked away from my faith, and like, I believed in God, but I was having a lot of issues and trouble with God, because why would God allow something like this to happen? And then seeing all the things that I saw in my career, and I was at the 11-year mark in my career when this happened, and I had seen enough. There were some questions as to, you know, would a God really allow this to happen? But then I started looking at all of these little God moments of when I got the phone call and who I talked to, and then all of these thoughts coming up around my dad, and then having this, you know, people from his life all of a sudden now showing up in my life 20 something years later, and they're showing me like the path out of the hole that I'm in. Like, that's absolutely God's work. And right. So that's really strong, and I still see it. And I still see those moments.
So I'm sure we could spend a ton of time, and I'm gonna keep pushing this here a little bit. But coming home, you're, and I don't want to ignore anything that you want to visit about that's obvious. But you've gone to the retreat, and you've had a tremendously dramatic, impactful turn in your life. What does coming home look like?
Oh my God, it was scary. Because I was going back into the same environment I was coming out of. But coming home, immediately I sat down with my wife. First, I asked her about her week, because it's not all about me. And then I told her about my week. I did tell her. I said, well, what I learned this week is I'm an alcoholic and I have PTSD. And like, how else do I say that, right? Let's just rip it off and get there. And so then she says, well, shit, I married my father. And I'm like, all right. So it opened up for some really good conversation. And so we started talking. We got into counseling. So it opened up communication with us because we knew that our marriage needed a lot of work. And so we started working on that because we made the commitment to do that. So the retreat has they also do retreats for spouses. And so 6 months later, she went through the spouses retreat and she learned all the same stuff I did. And when she went, it wasn't learning about me and why I'm all screwed up, right? When they do the spouses retreat, it focuses on the spouses. So she got to work on a lot of her childhood trauma and her past, and it allowed us to speak the same language. It really helped us in counseling, and the marriage counseling really helped because we learned how to communicate and how to start talking and you know, prioritizing things in life.
Sure.
So coming home was good, and it was the start of a whole new recovery process. In addition, like coming home, when things started going bad, when I left the retreat, here's what I left with: being a first responder and a fixer and just tell me what I need to do. I left knowing I'm an alcoholic. That's easy. As long as I don't drink anymore, everything's going to be fine. So that took less than a week when my wife and I were having an argument, disagreement. I don't know. My head was spinning in a million places about something and I couldn't drink over it. So then what do I do? So, you know, we have an assigned peer that we stay in contact with upon leaving the retreat. And I called him and grinded through it. I'm like, what's going on? And this and that. And so he says, well, it sounds like you need to go to a meeting. And I'm like, okay. And so a week after that, they have AA meetings down there. And it was an AA meeting in San Rafael for cops and firefighters. So I drove down there, met him at that meeting. And like that meeting was so profound because I met other folks, you know, not from the retreat, but I met other folks that were in recovery and they're telling their stories. And again, it sounds like they're telling mine. And so I'm like, all right. So that, and they started reading from the big book and I was really resonating with that, with the AA big book. So I realized that I need to open that up. They sent us home with a copy from the retreat. So I realized I need to open that up and start reading it. And I need to keep going back to the meetings. So I kept going back to the meetings. I was invited to go back to the retreat as a peer. And so going back, I went back to the retreat 2 months after I came out as a client. And even though I was only 2 months ahead and I had no idea what I was doing in my recovery, I was 2 months ahead of the guys that were sitting in there in the chair for the first time.
Right.
So I was able to help them through that. And one of them is still a really good friend of mine. And, you know, we stay in contact, but it was this constant giving back and helping others that had been in that spot. Because for me, what unlocked the door for me to get better was hearing other people tell their stories. And the more I told my story, like it released a lot of the shame because I knew I wasn't alone. And so without having that shame behind it and I could tell my story, I knew that I was giving the opportunity for other people to connect and maybe get some hope and get better themselves and to start that process. So, you know, going back as a peer, going to the first responder, 12-step meetings, like all of that stuff was huge parts of my recovery. And then, working on my marriage, working on my relationship with my kids. I got really involved in law enforcement peer support because that's what was working. And that's what opened the door for me. So I started and I still work very hard in that realm, in that arena, because I think it's like, we all need help. And I tell my story. I'm here today to tell my story, hoping that there's someone out there who was like, holy crap, I thought I was the only one. And it's okay to ask for help. One of the biggest things that kept me from asking for help early on, I thought that if I told anyone I didn't want to wake up in the morning or I didn't want to go on living, the answer to that was they're going to take my badge, they're going to take my gun, they're going to put me in an institution, and I'm going to lose my livelihood. And that's the only thing that I have going for me in my life. I cannot lose my livelihood. Well, I'm here to tell you that I'm still working in this profession, and I didn't get locked up. They didn't lock me up and throw away the key because I wasn't actively suicidal at the time. I just didn't want to live anymore. And we were able to work through that. So I've learned how to create a life that I want to keep on living in. I want to be like, I love the world that I live in now. And, you know, I want to continue being a part of that. I enjoy giving back. The law enforcement peer support stuff opened the door to working with Concerns of Police Survivors. So I had never really been a part of that organization. I knew they existed, but I was doing my cop peer support stuff, and I was doing all that. And then I heard that cops had a kids camp, and I thought, oh man, that sounds like a lot of fun. So I started doing some exploring on the cops kids camp to find out how I can get in on that and go be a camp counselor at kids camp. And I stumbled across, when I was on their page for their hands-on programs, I stumbled across their adult children's retreat. I was looking at that going, adult children, that's my category. I fall in, like, they have something that I can go to, like, as a participant? And I'm like, I don't need that, but I should go anyway, so I'll just go check it out. And it's also open to, you can bring your spouse. So I signed up for it right there, and I got home from work and I told my wife, I said, hey, in a couple months, we're going to go to Missouri, somewhere out in the middle of nowhere, and go to this camp thing. And she's like, we're what? Hey, I signed up for it. Here's what it is. And she's like, okay. So I get out.
Nobody's ever heard of Potosi, Missouri.
I had never heard of Potosi before.
Yeah, nobody had.
You know, only those that have been there.
Yeah.
I still hear the banjo music.
That's right.
But, you know, so I get out there to this adult children's retreat and like, I didn't know what to expect. And I had years of recovery under my belt. I wasn't 100% sure, but I'm like, okay, well, I got this, whatever. But I'm sitting in the back, I'm sizing up the room, you know, I'm looking at everyone and just not saying anything. And like, all right, well then, I'm walking out and on the name tags, they had the end of watch dates for our parents on the name tag. And I'm walking by and there's this guy standing against the wall and his dad's end of watch was 7 days. It was a week after my dad was killed, same year. And so I looked at his name, I pointed his name tag and I held up mine and I go, it looks like we had a really shitty August. And he kind of looks at me sideways at the beginning, and then he looks at my name tag and like he relaxes, lets down the sigh of relief, and we go out in the hallway and we just start talking. And it was almost like we had known each other forever. Well, as it turns out, you know, he went down the firefighter route. I went the police route, but we were right around the same age when our dads were killed. And obviously, so we're the same age now. And we started talking and we started talking about our families and, you know, upbringings and the family dynamics and this and that. And it was like, we had been living these parallel lives. I never knew that this guy had, you know, for 30 something years, I had a twin brother, right, in another part of the country. And like, again, it just opened up. And I realized, you know, going out to that even though I did all the law enforcement peer support stuff, there was this whole piece about being an adult child that I hadn't worked on. So I was able to be around other people. And then in the breakout sessions, my wife went to the breakout session for the spouses of us adult children. And she made some friends there because the stuff she's experiencing living with me and all of my quirks, there were other people that had experienced the same thing. And so she was able to share that and she had that experience with them. And we've made lifelong friends through that avenue because again, we all have that shared experience. And these are people, well, you know, the guy that I met, he's a firefighter, and there are a couple cops in the group, but there's a lot of people in the group that, regardless of what profession we're in, you know, we all lost our dads or our moms in the line of duty, and whatever else comes from that. And that shared similar trauma that we have, really, it binds us, but it gives us the ability to work through it and get better. So I went to that for the first time in 2019. I've been going every year since. In that time, I was able to find out how to get into kids camp and how to be a counselor or a mentor there. So for the last 2 years and coming up this year, I've been a mentor at COPS Kids Camp and Young Adults Camp. So Kids Camp is for kids age 6 to 14, and then Young Adults is 15 to 20. And going there and being a part of those programs has just been so amazing for me and part of my recovery, because I didn't have that when I was a kid. But it's so cool to go sit with those kids, and, you know, you have these young kids that are showing up to camp, and this is the first time maybe they've been around other kids who also lost a parent in the line of duty. And so they have that shared experience. And then, you know, we get into the cabin and I sit down with these kids, you know, the first night, and we're doing introductions and getting to know each other. And I'm like, hey, me too. I lost my dad too. And, you know, some kind of look up. And so when I say I know what you're going through, I actually know what they're going through. And we have that. And so that's just, it's really cool. And with young adults, I love that camp, because, you know, I was 13 when my dad was killed. And I'll tell you, between 14 and 20, those were like the hardest years of my life. It was horrible. And so I get to sit with those kids and say, yeah, it was horrible. And for you guys, it probably is horrible. Just know this, it doesn't stay horrible forever. And you have other people that have experienced it. So when you're having a horrible time, share it. And here's other people. I'm another person who has lived your experience. So let's talk about it. And if you're having a hard day, you can call me. And I'm not going to judge you. I'm not going to tell you what you need to do. I'm just going to listen. And we'll get through it. It's so powerful to just have those other people around that know what it's like. And I'm just comforted. You know, for me, it's meaningful to be there for those people and like offer that service and to be that support. And on the flip side, it's so comforting for me to know that I have people that are there for me. I know that I'm not alone. I know that I'm not the only one that has experienced what I've experienced. And when I'm ever having that feeling that I'm alone in this world and, you know, I'm getting down in the dumps and having my own little pity party, I can stop for a minute and go, no, I'm not the only one. It's not just me. And I have other people that I can pick up the phone and call when I'm going through it. And they do get it. And like, it just, the whole thing makes this life worth living. And that,
well, I want to applaud you for that, because that takes a special person to actually be that vulnerable and allow themselves the opportunity to be in an environment that relives that pretty frequently. You're going to relive that every time you connect with another human, whether it be a, you know, a teen, a preteen, or even an adult. You walk. But I also know from personal experience that there's a lot of freedom that comes from actually telling that story and talking about that pain, that the freedom comes. And then if you really relate that to AA in the big book, that it talks about specifically in there, this helps you on your journey to share with another person. So that is powerful. And just so we kind of establish clarity on concerns of police survivors. This is their 40th year anniversary.
It is.
Susie Sawyer put this together back. I actually had at the event we were talking about where we were talking, where I missed your talk. I had the opportunity to visit with her a little bit and talk about how that dream of, you know, in 1984 of taking that dream and what could you possibly imagine that it would be today, what you thought it was back 40 years ago, you know, and some of the hurdles. And it was just a great conversation, but you know, offering that up, but specific to concerns of police survivors is all about connecting people. It's all about connecting. And because they've understood for years, for decades, that connecting people, is part of the rebuilding shattered lives. And I don't know their mantra. I've forgotten it's something about that rebuilding shattered lives, but this connection is the key piece to it of, and that's not just connecting somebody who doesn't know. This is connecting people who say, I see you, I've been there myself. Let's walk through this together. It's just an amazing process.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story, Matt. This has been an absolutely an incredible conversation, and sharing your journey and actually being so vulnerable here to say, here's where I was at. Here's where I was at as a broken human, and actually giving people hope, possibly listeners out here who may or may not be in a similar spot. If they are in a similar spot, giving them some type of hope of saying, hey, maybe I could get help or live a different life. If you had, and I'm going to kind of tee this up for you, if you had a couple pieces of advice for people who were hurting, or maybe drinking was a problem for them, or if they, you know, if they were in dark places, or they just felt like, you know, this, I have no hope. If you had a couple pieces of advice for those people, what would you say to them? What would be kind of your connecting pieces of advice for how to turn their life around?
Well, number one, if you're there, ask for help. Mm-hmm. That's where it starts. And when you're in a hole, quit digging. So when you've realized that it's time and you're fed up, then you need to change. You need to make changes in your life. And when you ask for help, help looks like a lot of different things. And some, there's good help, there's bad help. Find the good help. And if the help doesn't feel right, then find some help somewhere else. But if you get around other people that have been in the same hole, they will help guide you. That makes it easier. Right. So find your tribe. And it's ongoing. There's not just one thing that you have to do. If you're struggling and you ask for help and you get on that path, you've got to stay on that path, but it's not straight. So when there's pitfalls and bumps and turns and twists and inclines and declines, like, stick with it. You can't go 30 days and go, well, I made the 30-day mark. Great. I'm going to celebrate and go do, you know, whatever it was that I was doing before, because you're going to go right back there. You know, you get to 30 days and then you hit a pitfall. Okay, work through the pitfall, work through the program, but don't ever give up. I have been sober for over 13 years now. It has not been a straight line. I still struggle on days. There are days where, you know, I just feel horrible. There are days where I feel like giving up. There are days where I want to drink. There are days, you know, there are times where I'm like, oh my God, why am I doing this? Why do I want to go on anymore? You know, that pity party. Stick with the recovery, keep moving in the right direction, and you know, do it for yourself and don't ever freaking give up.
That's great advice, man. Great advice. Captain Matt Blush, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing your story. We are so grateful to have such a continued powerful series of people and speakers coming on the podcast. So thank you for taking the time. Appreciate you.
Thank you, Brad. It's an honor.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's First Responder Resiliency Program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.